From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. On the 29th of July, Bletchley Park's royal patron, His Royal Highness the Duke of Kent, officially opened our World War I exhibit, The Road to Bletchley Park. Many of those World War I Codebreakers went on to work at Bletchley Park during the Second World War, and among them was Alistair Denniston, the first operational head of the Government Code and Cipher School. In our August episode, we featured an edited version of an interview with two of Commander Denniston's granddaughters, Candy Connolly and Judith Finch. In this extra, we bring you the full interview with them as they talk with pride about AGD. Before that, we sat down with author and historian on Bletchley Park, Dr. Joel Greenberg, for an overview of the Commander's secret work. This episode is being released today, the 30th of September, as part of International Podcast Day, and we welcome any new listeners to our show. This is what we call an extras episode, where we follow up an earlier story with more content so you can delve deeper into a subject. Our normal podcast is released on the 10th of each month, and we bring you stories told by the actual veteran codebreakers, world-renowned authors and historians, our staff and volunteers, and, occasionally, the odd Hollywood A-lister.
Just finally, how important is it, do you think, that Bletchley Park is kept alive and accessible to people?
Hugely important. I mean, that was the environment where men and women from all walks of society, from all abilities, whether it be actors and artists to the more likely candidates of mathematicians and physicists and scientific thinkers, came together to try and crack a code, or many codes actually, that were the encryption devices of the Nazis, and they were winning the war. The country was starving, the clock was ticking, as is portrayed in the pacing thriller element of our film. And to understand the importance of that is also to understand the importance of those men and women and the actual environments of where it happened. So to experience something of that through the extraordinary exhibits and explanations you get, both of the working environment and the tools, the actual, you can see the machine, you can hear the machine working, and it's amazing. You think from that came a reading of a code that basically won us the Second World War, some estimate by 2 years, and that meant millions of lives were saved. And it was all done in secret, and now we can look at that secret. So how could that not be one of the most important legacies we have in our culture of that era? It's incredibly important that it keeps going, incredibly important that it's open to the public and something that's well-funded and supported and continues, because this is our history.
Our exclusive content will keep you up to date on all our events, exhibits and lectures, and of course, the progress of the development of Bletchley Park Museum. So, enough of me. We hope everyone has a great International Podcast Day, and here's Joel.
At the end of World War I, the two British code-breaking groups, the Navy or Admiralty's group, Room 40, and the Army's group, MI1B, were merged, a new organization created called the Government Code and Cipher School. And one of the Room 40 group, Alistair Denniston, was appointed operational director. So Denniston's task was during peacetime to run this fairly small organization. But as they started to approach World War II, when clearly it looked like there would be war, Denniston realized that he needed to grow his organization. So as he that came up with this idea of going around the universities of Britain, identifying people with the right skills and who had agreed in the event of war to undertake secret work for the Foreign Office. He drew up a list, which he always quaintly called men of the professor type, about 56 men. There were also 30 women who were known as girls at that time. And the day after war was declared, these people started to arrive. Denniston then eventually moved to Bletchley Park, where the organization was set up, MI6's war station for intelligence, if you like, and they operated here for the rest of the war. Denniston was then tasked with the problem of growing this organization. By the end of 1941, early 42, Denniston had had some considerable success. They were starting to read Enigma encrypted messages and crack other systems used by the enemies of Britain. He'd facilitated collaboration between the United States and Britain as well. So he'd had great success. but the organization was perhaps outgrowing him. He did have periods of illness. A decision was taken at the end of 1941 to change things around a bit. Denison was sent to London, given responsibility for diplomatic and commercial wireless traffic, and his deputy, Edward Travis, was given responsibility for the service side of the operation based at Bletchley Park. You could view it as a demotion, but in any event, Denison operated in Berkeley Street in London, running the diplomatic and commercial traffic for the rest of the war. Interestingly enough, it became a huge success. Several reasons for that. It probably did suit Denison to run a smaller organization. He had about 300-400 people working for him. As the war wound down and Germany was pushed inside its borders, there was less and less wireless Enigma traffic. They were using landlines and other methods for communicating, but the diplomatic channels were red hot with traffic flowing all around the world. And that's what Denison's team were doing. They were reading the traffic, wireless commercial traffic, diplomatic traffic of half the countries in the world. So suddenly Denison's operation in Berkeley Street became a hot topic. It is interesting that so successful were they, the two major reports written about the Berkeley Street operation are still classified to this day because clearly there are sensitivities about the sort of traffic that was being made. So Denison was hugely successful. Sadly, when he retired at the end of the war, he was sort of pushed to one side. There was no recognition of him at all when he died in the 60s, no obituaries in the national newspapers, and no official recognition of him.
Well, I'm very, very lucky because I'm sitting in a very important chair at the moment and I'm being looked at by two ladies who have a very important relation who used to sit in a chair in this office. Would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Candy Connolly. I'm Robin Denniston's daughter, that is A.G. Denniston's granddaughter.
And I'm Judith Finch and my mother was A.G. Denniston's daughter, so he's my grandfather as well.
And I think I wouldn't be going too far to say how proud both you ladies are of your grandfather, are you?
Very proud and amazingly fortunate to be sitting in this office of his, as it was in a way in 1939 when they first came here. So it's an amazing office.
We're here today for the official opening of the road to Bletchley Park. There's that direct link with your grandfather to here, to this office, and that started in room 40, didn't it?
Most definitely. My grandfather was called up to room 14 in August. He was there August the 3rd of 1914 when the First World War was declared. Then they had no idea of what to do with these new radio waves, bringing messages that they had never dealt with before, and they were working out what to do with them. So right from the beginning, he was in room 40. And he saw the mistakes that were made in room 40 as well as the amazing discoveries. I think room 40 itself was a kind of a real learning chamber of how to deal with this information. And he was at the heart of all the activity.
Your grandfather, in a way, was quite visionary all the way through his professional life, wasn't he? Because it wasn't just working in room 40. It was from room 40 to setting up the government code and cipher school, down to things like having that dry run where people came here in 1938, didn't they, during the Munich crisis?
Well, that's absolutely true. Bletchley Park was the concept of needing a place outside London before World War II erupted was very much in their minds of the people that were managing the coast because they could hear all the information. They knew that war would be on its way. But I think his vision actually comes from a much deeper root because he, being a Scot, was taught that education was so important. And as an 18-year-old, he went to Bonn University for studying. He also went to the Sorbonne. So not only was he a trilingualist, but he'd actually lived in Germany. He'd lived in Paris. He knew how the people there worked and what their culture was. So he had quite a cosmopolitan outlook. He lost his father when he was 11. His father died at sea. His father was a doctor who had actually been a missionary doctor in the Turkish wars. So I think his father had quite a sort of outreach globally feeling. And so the idea of travel was very much part of AGD's sort of childhood. What is there beyond the British shores, probably? And I think also when his father, he was at Erzurum when it was besieged by the Russians, And one of the things his father had said in his letters was that actually these Turks are nice for a cup of tea. I don't think they had much conversation, but clearly actually making a relationship, obviously with his patients and with their families, was something that was part of AGD's upbringing, is that you make relationships, and that is something that is at the heart of his work with code breaking
as
well.
All the way through his life, wasn't it?
All the way through his life. I think it's very interesting with Judith here, her mother, Margaret, as a child, she was going to go and stay with other code breaking families in Poland. It actually never came to pass because the war came a bit sooner than that happened. I think she went to America and stayed with a family in America for some months. So the relationship with America was actually founded on a more personal kind of exercise, which is what my grandfather was very special.
And it was this room that we're sitting in now, Commander's office, where the special relationship between the British and the American SIGINT sections was born over sherry, wasn't it?
Well, certainly the first big envoy of the Americans came to this room before Pearl Harbor, before there was an official relationship for code sharing and code breaking in this room. So in some ways you could say for World War II, the sharing of information and skills, and in fact what then happened was Americans came over to work at Bletchley. He had also seen in World War I, in room 40, the importance of sharing with the Americans, because of course, as we see from the wonderful exhibition here of the World War I road to Bletchley, in World War I there was this very special Zimmermann telegram, which with that information, the way that Admiral Hall, who was in charge of that information, used it was, I think AGD was able to see how the material had to be handled very carefully. It couldn't be just thrown open. You couldn't just throw your doors open. But until you threw your doors open, you wouldn't get their cooperation. So it was just how do you do that sharing in the most productive and careful way without losing the secrecy.
And I think that sharing and that learning from other people also points back to a story that you were telling me earlier about how he was actually given the job of running the government code and cyber school, wasn't it?
Well, I was very lucky to hear this story from the historian from GCHQ. It was fascinating that I know that my grandfather was at Versailles, indeed with his wife, although I'm not sure that they were married at that stage. Anyway, he met his wife, incidentally, in room 40, but they were both at Versailles. And at Versailles, there was a feeling that there should be now no more listening on other people's private conversations. But being a linguist, he could hear that the Germans were not happy and that it would be very important to keep listening. So that then in 1919, Churchill did say that there should be a small group, you know, no funds for it, but that there should be a listening opportunity kept going. And they had to decide who was to be leading this small group, because obviously, as we've seen from the exhibition, there was the military listening and the naval listening. So they interviewed Major Hay from the military, and they said to Major Hay, what would you feel if you were deputy to AGD, or indeed if you had AGD as your deputy? To which he very strongly responded, AGD has nothing to teach me. I don't need him, and I wouldn't need to work with him. Then A.G. Denniston was interviewed and was asked, what would you feel if you were deputy to Major Hay, or he deputy to you, how would you feel that would work? And he said, whatever will serve the country best, I would work with him to make the United information more valuable. And after that, he was given the job.
I think the nice thing about this new exhibition is it gives people, maybe for the first time, a glimpse into the commander's background. And it's the start, hopefully, of people learning more and more about what he actually did, not just here during the war, which is fundamentally important, but prior to that, we've got a new biography being written about him currently, haven't we?
We have a new biography, a very lucky Joel Greenberg, who did the superb biography of Gordon Welshman, has undertaken to do a biography for my grandfather. The interesting thing is that although he'd done this really important work in the First World War, between the wars, in the Second World War, when he died in 1961, there was not one mention of him in any paper. So it was like his name was sort of pushed under the carpet. And that is curious. There will be reasons why that we will learn, I'm sure, as things are more unfolded. But when you see Bletchley Park becoming so strong now in our modern history and in modern life, and we make the connections through Bletchley of the history of the code breaking, now brings us the technology that we use every day. That connection is amazing. And so in time, I'm sure AGD will find his place.
I think he's well overdue, isn't he?
I think he's well
I think he is well overdue. And I think Bletchley Park have done a fantastic job with putting the office that we're sitting in now back to how it was, and making sure then when people come to visit the park, the part that he actually played. And also now with having the Road to Bletchley Park exhibition as well, that really focuses again on the work that happened in Room 40 and how that led up to the work that happened in Bletchley Park. And also then with the book that Joel's writing, hopefully that will then put the end part of the story, because obviously he went on to have a diplomatic career after Bletchley Park.
What did he do after the war?
After the war, he was a teacher. The diplomatic work was in the decoding of diplomatic codes, which is what he did when he left Bletchley Park.
Oh, right.
He set up another decoding operation in London, which was also very important, but isn't much known about at the moment.
So more to come from Dr. Greenberg, hopefully, on that.
I think there is there's an untold story there. He was 65, so when he retired, he stopped his work.
And left two very, very proud granddaughters.
Most definitely.
Yes.
My father wrote a book, it's called The 30 Secret Years, because his father had done so much, which Dad told me about, but I could never remember it. So I did say to him, please, Dad, please write it down, because I will never remember these things. You know, for example, my grandfather was the translator for Admiral Beatty at the Scapa Flow. So at the surrender of World War One, he was the person actually writing down the words. And these things I knew I would not remember if Dad didn't write it down for me. But in the preface to that, he talks about Libby, who was AGD's goddaughter and indeed also his niece. So AGD had a sister who he was very, very fond of. And Libby is the daughter of that sister. And he used to look after her when she came to her boarding school. And this was in 1936 to 38. He made time to walk with her across London from one station to another. So he had this very caring side, especially for young ones. And I think he also had a great sense of humour. He used to say that getting Libby past an ice cream van was like getting a dog past a lamppost. So he was a lovely chap.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.